Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. This week, we look to Paris and the Climate Change Conference, otherwise known as COP21. It's the successor to the Kyoto and Copenhagen meetings that also tried to address the issue, both of which ended rather underwhelmingly, failing to reach concrete terms. This round of talks is said to be different, with momentum from the world's governments and climate activists, as well as the march of technology providing real alternatives to fossil fuels. But like any international agreement, getting everyone to agree will not be easy. With the division of responsibility for action between richer countries and poorer countries causing tension. To talk us through the conference and to discuss whether Paris will usher in real change is Sarah Ladislaw, the Director of our Energy and National Security Program at CSIS.
I think one of the things that's really important to understand about international climate negotiations is that typically the expectations that are heaped upon them are much bigger than what any agreement could ever accomplish. And I think that was true in Kyoto. I think it was true in Copenhagen. And I think people were working really hard to make that not true in Paris. That what that means is that any single agreement could never guarantee that the world community could do something that's really quite difficult, which is to decarbonize the entire energy sector and to make sure that we have built sort of the systems and infrastructure that we'll need to deal with a changing and adapting climate. And so what this the importance of this agreement is that you basically, for the first time in history, have a group of over 180 countries all saying that they will contribute to a solution. That's different than in the past. In the past, the core of the debate was, what will developed countries do to help developing countries deal with climate change, and also what actions are they going to take to reduce emissions and solve the climate change problem? That is still part of these negotiations, but this time it is much more about how everybody is going to start trying to row in the same direction and the fact that everybody needs to put something on the table. And so when you listen to Cristina Figueres, the head of the UNFCCC, talk about what's happening over these last 2 weeks, the agreement is only one of four major points she makes. The first is that you had more world leaders than you've ever had in one place at one time for one issue gathered to signal how important they think this is. The second is all the actions and activities that each country that's present has pledged to put into, you know, their own commitment to this issue. And the third is like all the private sector funding and financing that's being announced for clean energy technology development, reducing emissions, adaptation, a whole host of things. And then the fourth is the agreement itself. And so what they're trying to do is communicate to the global community that the solutions to this problem are actually much bigger and coming from places outside the negotiations themselves.
Why is it now? What happened in the intervening years? Is it just a tipping point of technology and political pressure? Because it almost seems too good to be true that everyone will be coming together like this.
Yeah, and I think you're right. You can't be too optimistic about what everybody coming together actually yields, right? When you add up everything that everybody is committed to do, it still falls short of, you know, limiting temperature rise to 2 degrees. It does not fully fund what, you know, most people can estimate as the full cost of adapting to a changing climate. And so the downside of the story is that while everybody has agreed to do something, the somethings all added up together are not enough. And so this is where that tension between developed and developing economies is really quite important, because developing economies are certainly the ones sort of, you know, in the context of the negotiations saying this is not enough. And especially for small island developing states that face an existential threat of sea level rise, they're the first ones at the table to say, you know, this is not a theoretical end of the century issue for us. This is present and here and now. And what you're putting on the table basically doesn't take into consideration our very, you know, sort of dire circumstances. I think the reality of the situation is that we've been at this now, this negotiating, this talking about this issue for over 20 years, and folks have realized that other types of agreements where you basically try and force people to do more, or you try and, you know, hold them accountable in some way, shape, or form that's, you know, particularly onerous, basically, you know, makes it implausible for them to come to an agreement, right? And so what every country right now is doing is putting their best effort on the table and then committing to try to do more and try to figure out how more becomes easier to do over a period of time. And I think that that is, you're right, that sort of technological progress and actually trying to implement some of these solutions has helped improve the conversation because we're learning by doing. And so things that probably 10 years ago seemed like implausibilities are actually happening around the world now. And so people have a little bit more confidence about their ability to actually tackle this pretty large problem.
I want to talk about measurement, because obviously we can say that everything's going to change, but knowing that it's changing is a different thing. And there was news a couple of weeks ago that China had to readjust its coal consumption figures. It was actually higher than previously thought. How are we going to know that it's happening? How are we going to hold people accountable in that way?
Yeah, accountability is a really important issue. And if you're not able to, you know, put penalties on people for not fulfilling their activity, the currency of trust in these negotiations is transparency. And transparency from an emissions reduction standpoint can only be achieved through sound measurement. And so one of the biggest issues in the negotiations is that you've got some countries who have very sophisticated methods of measuring and cataloging and tracking their emissions, which quite frankly came out of earlier negotiating processes and requirements. And then you've got countries that simply don't have that capability. The Chinese example is a really interesting one. You know, on the one hand, people saw the higher coal consumption numbers for China as a really damaging sign for the negotiations because, my gosh, you know, if they could be so wrong, what do we even, you know about, you know, what they're emitting? But on the other hand, you know, the idea that the Chinese are trying really hard to get better at tracking their energy consumption and their emissions is absolutely an essential step to getting better at this. There are countries around the world who are very concerned that they're going to be asked to do something they don't have the capacity to do, which is measure emissions in a really sort of, you know, precise way. I think that that's where a lot of the assistance from a multilateral institution like the UNFCCC is really important, where they're going to try and build capacity in countries, because we really do need to get a handle on, you know, where emissions reduction is coming from. And so that's going to be, you know, once all the lights fade in Paris and no one's paying attention anymore, that's where a lot of the real work is in trying to get countries and companies and, you know, governments better able to measure and track these kinds of activities. And that'll be something we do for several decades, but is certainly part of this process.
Let's talk about the rich countries and poor countries. The Indian Prime Minister talked about, Narendra Modi talked about climate justice and the idea that his country and countries like his just didn't have the economic capacity to polluting as much in the past. And if they're polluting a little more now, it's not like it's any worse than what the US or other countries were doing. And obviously that's not a great way to be going towards reducing emissions. But what can the rich countries do? What can the developed world do to provide incentives?
So India is in a really interesting place in these negotiations because not only are they a very large developing economy, they serve as sort of a figurehead for the G77, which is a larger block of developing economies. And they're the ones that, quite frankly, over a period where the question of whether or not the world can figure out how to deeply decarbonize will be growing the most. And so they are in a very politically sensitive place where they really want to protect their right to grow. I think that makes India one of the more fascinating countries in the world to watch over the next several decades, because it's really the proof of concept, right? We do not absolutely know that countries can develop that big and that quickly and do it in a low-carbon way. But there is a huge amount of attention being put through the Indian government and through, you know, the international community into trying to prove that concept that you can have sort of rapid industrialization or rapid economic growth and bring people out of poverty, and you don't have to follow the same sort of development pathway. We have examples of where this works around the world, but we don't have large-scale examples where it has worked in its entirety. And India, very rightly, because they understand understand, you know, sort of the politics of their situation and the reality for their country is they've got to be able to develop. And so they're going to defend their right to do so. I have not heard anybody in the international context, you know, try and say that that isn't, you know, something that they should be enabled to do. And it shouldn't be supported. But I think what you will find people saying is we have to find ways to help them if there is an alternative pathway to be able to do that. And so I think that they play a very important role, not only in sort of voicing those concerns within the international context, but also in terms of actually watching whether or not, you know, we can figure out how to do this in a less carbon intensive way. A lot of that will play out, you know, in India and various parts of India.
I'm talking politics for a second, but world opinion as well. It seems that a lot of the build-up and the pressure that's come toward this Paris summit has been based because people's attitudes in, you know, people on the ground have been saying, you know, climate change is a big issue and it's an issue that affects me, and I feel like it's important. And that's broadly across the world. And Pew had a study out showing that that's true, that average opinion is majority in favor of saying it's a very serious issue, except in the US and China, where it's less than a majority. And even in this election campaign, it's not exactly been on people's stump speeches on either side, really. Is that a challenge then to making sure that these agreements are going to be followed through with, that there is that political pressure there and there is that pressure from the ground up to make something happen?
I think public support and sort of public recognition of climate change as an issue is really important, but it's very different in different global political contexts, right? So in the United States, what you find is that climate change is a divisive issue in a political way that it just isn't in other countries. And so it's found this very sort of strange place, you know, within our own politics where, you know, on the Democratic side, it's certainly a mantle of the progressive base, right? I mean, it is a huge issue in the U.S. politics for those folks. And then maybe on the more Republican conservative base, it's sort of the polar opposite. And so it's a bit of a wedge issue, which is a little strange. In the Chinese context, what I find is that climate change as a topic, as a word, doesn't resonate particularly high. But if you talk to people about local air pollution, if you talk to people about environmental safety and interest, sustainability issues more broadly, or if you talk to them, you know, especially high-level policymakers in China, about the need to be a leader in science and technology innovation or a converting the economy from something that's energy intensive and export oriented to something that's consumption oriented and service sector oriented. Climate change, decarbonization, all those sorts of things fit into those other baskets without sort of the label. And so I think that it's really hard to look at polling about a particular issue because the issue means different things to different people in different countries. When you talk and sort of break that issue down for folks, what you find is, sure, there is a much larger level of political support for an agreement like what's being reached in Paris or some of the activities that are happening in some of these countries. And so I think I think political support is actually what's making a lot of things succeed in the climate negotiations this time around. And I think the climate advocacy community has been extremely successful in finding pockets of niches of ways to sort of promote these kinds of policies and use public support to their advantage. And so that's actually probably been one of the bright sort of stories of the last 20 years is really how much people are paying attention to the subset issues that go into that basket we call climate change.
And, you know, oftentimes to get people's attention, it's a lot of doom and gloom about climate change and about what would happen if we don't act. Is there some sort of a bright side that's even happening right now in terms of the pace of developments in technology and developments in how people are using energy and efficiency? There's a movement now divesting from coal. Coal is obviously a little less popular. It's an energy source. Is it going to come to that tipping point quite soon then that it just makes economic sense and people are going to be using more green technologies?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of positivity. And in fact, I think one of the things people have realized in sort of messaging and talking about climate change, that, you know, talking about the disasters that await us, you know, at the end of the century is not super compelling in getting people to do things. What is compelling and what is successful is just to try it. Just to get about the business and put your head down and start working on the issue. And what you find is, you know, already in many parts of the world, renewables and energy efficiency are providing, energy efficiency is providing cost savings. Renewables are cost competitive to a lot of fossil generation units. And you're starting to see higher and higher levels of penetrations into the electric power sector. You're seeing huge amounts of experimentation about, you know, different electric power grids, different fuels for the transportation sector. There's a lot of activity. In fact, we have a hard time keeping up with all of the ways in which innovation, both from a policy perspective and a technology perspective, is happening. And that's all really, really great. I do think it's important to note that with all of that going on, you know, the fossil-based conventional energy system still exists and is still going to prevail in a lot of places around the world. What I find particularly positive is that it is now more and more for companies and the people that actually do this business and for policymakers, it's really not an either-or question. It's trying to figure out how you can most cost-effectively or, you know, politically or regulatorily effectively get these price signals for carbon, for emissions into your system so that your just general practice of doing business is constantly leading you in a better direction. I think that is much more prevalent now than it has ever been in the history of this enterprise. And that will lead to a lot of good things going forward. And I think it kind of steers us away from, you know, the doom and gloom part of this, but also kind of this idea that you sort of have to do draconian things to pick one path or the other. I think it certainly does help lead us in a more productive direction.
And that was Sarah Ladislaw. We've reached the end of another CSIS podcast. And as usual, we'll return next week. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.